Okay, this is Dr. Snyder, so we're gonna start. Turn it over to Dr. Tudor.
Yes, sir. All right. Welcome, everyone. Good deal. We'll go ahead and call the meeting to order. Welcome, everyone. Appreciate you coming. I see Mark up there. Mark, are we going to do a roll call today?
Yes.
Yes, I'll be glad to do a roll call.
Thank you,
Mr.
Sir.
Mr. Rob Binky.
Here. I'm here.
Dr. Lisa Bellner.
Here.
Dr. John Brophy.
Yo.
Dr. Richard Cole.
I'm here.
Dr. Ceresia Cummings.
Here.
Ms. Lisa Hartman. Dr. Jeff Hazelwood.
Here.
Mr. Dan Hedrick. Ms. Jenny Howard.
Hello, here.
Ms. Lisa Hartman. I see you on the screen.
She's here.
All right. Dr. Tim Jones. Dr. Greg Kaiser.
I'm here.
Ms. Amy Moses. Dr. Wills Oglesby. Dr. Robert Snyder.
Here.
Ms. V. Story. Was that a yes? Ms. V. Story. Dr. Jim Talmadge. I see you on the screen. Okay. Dr. David Tudor. And Ms. Misty Williams.
I'm here.
Okay, we have more than enough for a quorum. So you do have a quorum, Dr. Tudor.
Mr. Finks, yes. This is Lisa Hart, and I had gone out and come back in because my speakers wasn't working, and I missed the roll call, so I'm here.
All right, I've got you marked as present. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt, Dr. Snyder.
Now, you're good, Lisa. Welcome. We want to introduce the Bureau team that's on with us today.
Okay.
Any Bureau employees that are with us today?
I'm here, Troy Haley, Administrator. I see Dr. Oglesby coming in. He's walking in from outside, so he should be in shortly, Mark.
All right,
I'll mark him present. And this is Mark Fink, staff attorney with the Bureau.
Susie Douglas, medical services coordinator with the Bureau.
Susie. All right. Anyone else with us today? What about visitors? Visitors or public member or public representatives with us today?
Yarnell Beatty, Tennessee Medical Association.
Faith Parish, Vanderbilt.
Adam James.
Alex O'Neill with ArbiCare. Morgan.
Mary Brenton with Acuro Solutions.
Susan Stewart, Coventry Workers' Comp.
Anyone else? All right. Well, great. Appreciate everyone being here today. We'll move on to approval of minutes from our September 5th meeting. Everyone should have received a copy of the minutes. Do we have any comments or corrections? If not, we'll accept a motion to accept.
So moved, Rick Cole.
Thank you. Second?
I second it, Rob.
Second, Rob, thank you. Any opposed? No? Good. We'll accept the minutes as written. Hopefully everyone has turned in their conflict of interest forms, but I'm guessing since it's still on the agenda, we haven't. So if you haven't completed the conflict of interest form, it was in the email from Dr. Snyder. Please complete that. And Susie, should they return that to you?
Yes, please. And we are missing some. So thank you for mentioning it.
Okay. You are welcome.
Just to make sure we haven't embarrassed any members, Susie will notify you in the email if you don't have the conflict of interest form. So we won't make those names public.
Very good. All right. Well, we are moving right along today. We'll jump into old business. And so no ODG update.
I received the latest update yesterday morning.
Oh, okay.
And I will include it in the next in our next meeting. It looks like the only thing that really has changed is some criteria updates for diagnostic imaging. And so I'll include that in next the next meeting's agenda.
Okay. Very good. So trazodone.
So Dr. Kaiser brought this to my attention and asked for and sent us an article that I included in the email as an attachment on the use of trazodone for insomnia. ODG has listed that as a N medication for insomnia. The medication itself is off-label use for insomnia. But Dr. Kaiser, I think if you'll go ahead, I think what you're asking for us to essentially ask ODG to reevaluate that in the fact that trazodone's a generic medication. It's not likely people are going to do any studies to get approval from the FDA for insomnia with a medication that would not, in fact, increase their sales. So do you want to say anything further about that?
Yeah, I would just say that – can you hear me okay now?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, sorry. I still can't get my camera to work. I apologize. I would just say a couple of things. Number one is that that's the most common use for trazodone is a hypnotic. It's a lousy antidepressant, but most people will sleep better with it. And the thing that is rather kind of the irony of the situation to me is that oftentimes if I prescribe a legitimate sleeping medication like Ambien or Lunesta or whatever else, I'll get pushback saying that I shouldn't use that. And if I tried trazodone, and you know, so typically, you know, especially like in the workers' comp setting, I've kind of learned, you know, to try trazodone first. You know, if somebody needs Ambien or something later on, you know, I may use that. But, you know, most people will do okay on trazodone. Some people don't. It's pretty well tolerated. The downside to it is not much. You know, very, very rarely people might have, you know, priapism with it. I don't know that I've seen it maybe once in 30 years. But to me, the irony of the situation is that we're often asked to prescribe trazodone through these peer review reports when they're trying to deny something else that they don't want you to take. It's almost free. I was just really kind of surprised to find that it wasn't actually a wide drug. I'd been operating all this time thinking that it was. And you know, 99 times out of 100, it just goes through and people act like it is a wide drug.
I think in pain management, it's commonly used. I think that and nortriptyline, from a chronic pain standpoint, as long as it's not used with polypharmacy, with opioids and muscle relaxers and all the other stuff, if people sleep better at night, their pain is better. It's non-addictive. think it's safe in my experience, so I would like to see it used as well. But that one and nortriptyline are the two that we use frequently in pain management to help sleep related to pain.
Is there any withdrawal from trazodone?
Typically not.
Okay.
So is it an end now just because that's off-label use?
I would assume that they quoted the same studies as Dr. Kaiser sent, and yet they have put it as a conditional recommendation, and they have it as an end drug. And so, yeah, as I said, there's a number of reasons why it's not likely, even though that's the most common reason for it, why it's not likely to be studied for insomnia, because there's no money in it for the pharmaceutical industry. And so I think that Dr. Talmadge's help, we'll try to summarize what has been said and request that ODG, in light of the fact that there are an awful lot of denials occurring with trazodone, even though the adjusters are saying that should be tried before. Some of these are should try it in place of some of the other hypnotics, that we should request that they reconsider that just based on the common information. Is that appropriate, Dr. Kaiser?
I believe so.
Okay. So somebody make a motion.
Okay. We need to take an action?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So do we have a motion to...
Well, I guess since I sent the letter to Dr. Snyder, that would be my motion, that it be, at least, reviewed by OGD. And my recommendation would be that it be placed as a Y drug, unless they can give us a compelling reason not to.
But it would be
that or make a statement that they need to quit telling me to use it instead of Ambien.
It would be for insomnia, not for depression.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
It's a lousy antidepressant. I mean, it's the indication is for depression, but it's not a great antidepressant by any means. But it's most common use by far and away is as a hypnotic, often in conjunction with other antidepressants.
Do we have a second?
A second.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff. Any opposed? No. Okay. We will make that recommendation.
Thank you much. If I could interject one moment, I really apologize to everyone. I have to leave early. I neglected to get the meeting on my schedule. I can be around for about an hour or so, but I'll probably slip off about 2:00. One thing, Dr. Snyder had sent out a letter to the Psychiatric Association. My understanding is we're going to send that to the membership, and we have a similar kind of council as this. Called the Executive Council, and I'm still on that. I think we're going to meet next week, and I will make some comments about that also at that time.
I appreciate it. Any help you can give us would be greatly appreciated.
Well, it's been very helpful for you to kind of put that information together and get it to us, especially like with the new fee schedule and all that kind of stuff too, and the tools that are available to help people kind of learn what they need to learn.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Medical fee schedule update?
Yeah.
So, effective September the 25th of 2023, our new rules for the medical fee schedule went into effect. There was some confusion about the date. That had to do with the fact that we did not get legislative approval until September the 21st for these. The legislature, the committee was supposed to meet in August, but they deferred their meeting during the special session. And as a result, they didn't meet on these rules until September the 21st. But according to the Attorney General's office, they went into effect on the date that the Secretary of State had posted. The first change in the rules was a new set of Z codes. These Z-codes take the place of the CPT codes that we have been using. A lot of them were not in accordance with the CPT book. And so in the CPT guidance, so we replaced those with the Z-codes that are specific to the state of Tennessee. There are special codes for a missed appointment, special codes for IMEs, special codes for case manager discussions, and also extra questions on causation. All of those have separate and new Z-codes. So make your billers aware of that. There are increased rates for medical subspecialists with what's called an OP modifier. So you would put that with your code. So it would be whatever 99304-OP, which increases the rates for medical subspecialists, including occupational medicine, psychiatry, pulmonology, PM&R, to 180% of Medicare. There are some additional codes and increased for behavioral health evaluation, an increased payment for final medical reports, and of note, the handbook on the website has been updated with these new codes. So if you want to go for a quick summary, that's on that. And then finally, the certified physician program went active again November the 1st. And so the new modifier for the CP registered physicians is -CP. We are going to include the NPI number so that the adjusters will be able to look for on our website for the certified physicians that are on the registry and then be able to get their NPI numbers for billing. So in our discussions, it didn't appear that though the NPI numbers were anything but private. So they're listed on the on the national website, so we didn't think that there would be anything special other than make it easier for the adjusters to look to have those up. So as it has to do with the Medicare guidelines, as of September the 24th, then all of the Medicare guidelines for the date of service will be followed through the end of December the 31st of 2023, and that includes Tennessee-specific conversion factors and other modifiers. As of January the 1st of 2024 through March 31st of 2024, the Medicare guidelines that were in effect for December the 31st, including the conversion factors, will remain in place. One of the problems that happened with workers' compensation was when Medicare originally announced their reductions that went into effect January the 1st of each year, Congress would go back and retroactively increase those. That would work for Medicare billing because Medicare has all the billing records and they could go back and reimburse the physicians who had been billed through Medicare. But that wasn't occurring in workers' compensation where every one of these bills that an individual of the 300 insurance companies would have printed to a provider would not get reimbursed according to the new Medicare rates. So this was in an effort to stabilize those until Congress gets an ability to act. And then from April the 1st of 2024 through March the 31st of 2025, then we are going to ask you to refer to the rate tables, which will be published by Fair Health and available in a digital and downloadable format free to the providers from a link that will be provided on our website. We will do a lot of outreach for that. It is expected that sometime around the 1st of March those rate tables will be available to all of the providers. And it depends upon when Congress acts as to how soon Fair Health can turn those rate tables around for us. So we will let you know then. And we will be... that will be on our website, but it'll also be to pretty much every every contact list that we have at the Bureau, including all of the adjusters, the insurance companies, and all the providers that we have on the list. So, any questions on the fee schedule?
Will the Z codes attach to the rate tables? Or yes. I mean, will there be an explanation of the Z codes with the rate tables?
Yes.
So if you download one, you'll get the whole.
That's right. But also in the fee schedule handbook that's presently published on our website,
yeah,
is a list of all those Z codes and what they can be used for. Okay. So that's in the updated, as are the explanation of the modifiers, the OP and the CP modifiers.
Any other comments or questions? No. Move on to the reward program.
Well, the certified physician program, it's been updated effective November the 1st. The program, we have approximately 10 physicians now that are fully registered, and we have another group of probably 20 physicians that are in the process of going through the education modules. So we're pleased with the response already so far. For those physicians that are already on the medical impairment rating registry, if you complete the education modules, you get the free CME credits, and then you will be considered for this certified physician program by tenure with the Medical Impairment Rating Registry.
Any questions?
Looks like Susie just posted those fee schedule rules and the CPP rules in the chat.
So we'll move on to the reward employer honor roll updates. Susie, have that for us today?
I hope so.
There she is.
I will be happy to update you. So, yes, the reward honor roll deadline has passed. That was November the 15th. And we are evaluating the applications we received, and we will be notifying parties of the honorees in January of 2024. However, the application process remains open, so any employer can also apply now for recognition in 2025. So the form stack process will be open all the way through next November the 15th. But we do want to continue to promote the reward program, and hopefully we can reach out to other employers who maybe didn't have a return to work program that they thought was exemplary and didn't apply for the honor roll, so that we can help them in the coming year maybe boost the return to work program and have more applicants even the following year. So any questions, feel free to reach out to me. Thank you.
How many applicants for the program this year?
We had 7 unique applications. Some of them were from multiple sites. So each individual employer location was allowed to apply, or one application could apply for multiple sites for an employer.
Okay. Very good. Thanks, Susie.
Thank you.
Next up, rules legislation update is Amanda. There she is with us. Hi, Amanda.
How is everybody? Rules and legislative update. Our rules, we have the CPP that started November the 1st that I believe Dr. Snyder was talking about, and also the medical fee schedule rules, that's 17, 18, and 19, if I'm remembering correctly. Those went into effect September the 25th, 2023. I believe that I currently have the MIRR rules signed in my inbox, but I need to check that. That's just an FYI. As for legislative updates, the General Assembly will reconvene on January the 9th of 2024. We have a couple of sunsets, which include, I believe, this committee and the medical payment committee, as well as the Bureau overall. And those were recommended for a five-year extension. So that's good news. And hopefully we will receive that. And I don't think that there's anything else. We aren't planning on doing anything really major this year. So that we have a few things like the sunset. That's about it. And then we anticipate, of course, seeing medical cannabis back on the bills again. But we don't know exactly how many or what or anything like that until they start being filed. So we'll be sure to track those. Troy, was there anything that I missed that you?
The only other thing I could think of is the firefighter PTSD bill from earlier this year. We have drafted rules for that grant program, and those are with the governor's office for review. And then once we get the okay on that, we will file that notice of rulemaking hearing with the Secretary of State, and we'll let everybody know when the rulemaking hearing is going to be on that.
Very good. Anyone have questions for Amanda or Troy?
Amanda, this is Misty Williams. Does that PTSD bill, I believe that goes into effect January 1st. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, guys. So I guess that was we know how the sunset hearing turned out now. So, well, we're here today. We're here, so I guess.
Yeah. Well, it was very gratifying for the Bureau that we were able to get unanimous approval for an extension, which is one of the longest that they've given to any department, any Bureau, or any set of committees. So
who approves that? Who does that?
Well, it first goes to the government operations, a subcommittee of the government operations committee. And they had a series of questions that went on for about 10 pages about what activities you do and what your purpose was and how much it costs and all those sorts of things. And then from that subcommittee, then the recommendation goes to each one of both the Senate and the House committees, government operations, to authorize the committees to continue then starting July the 1st of 2025.
Dr. Snyder, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just one thing that I missed mentioning since we're talking about that is thank you. On behalf of the Bureau, to everybody on the committee for all your hard work. That's one of the reasons that it was extended. So we certainly appreciate it. Thank you for your service.
So that's the process. Then once it clears that, then the governor signed off on the extensions.
Was it a little more streamlined? How long ago was it that we did that? Was that 5 years ago?
No, I believe it was either three or four. It
wasn't
that long ago, and it was a full audit. And this time it was not a full audit.
Okay.
We expect that the next time, though, it will be a full audit.
Okay.
So, we presented to them the same thing that we did the previous time, as it had to do with, the conflict of interest forms, the attendance for the committees,
right,
the diversity of the committee, the representation of the committee, and all those sorts of things that they look at as part of the whether it's it represents the citizens of the state of Tennessee. So, Amanda, anything to add to that?
No, nothing else to add. Thank you.
All right. So move on to UR.
Okay. We compiled. This was a report that I had promised in the spring that took a little bit longer to process because we had to figure out what to do with all of the information that we got from each one of the insurance companies. This was a new requirement that went into effect in 2022 to have the utilization review organizations report to us on their activities. And so it took us a little while to figure out what they sent us and then to get it into a form that would be usable going forward. I think one of the things we learned is that we are going to have to create, in spite of the fact that nobody likes forms, we're going to have to create some sort of checklist to get the information that we can use. And so that's why it took a little bit longer than what we thought, is because we had to put it into a, we had to figure out what we wanted to know from this form and then what they sent us. And so I tried to, we tried to make this, essentially there are three spreadsheets involved in this, okay? And so if you, you guys on the, if you want to open the attachment, if you haven't. So on page one, we have the utilization review organizations that are reported to us, okay? These organizations, I think there were about 30 of them reported. We have about 70 organizations that do utilization review or that are registered with the Commerce and Insurance to do utilization reviews. So we got about half a response, which I thought for the first year was pretty good. Although we could penalize them, I think the most important thing is we want to create something that's worthwhile, and we need their participation to do it without being, you know, you want to use carrots and not sticks to the best you can. And so some of the interesting things were just the number of utilization reviews in Tennessee that are done by some of these organizations, okay? And just for examples, you've got Sedgwick and you've got Travelers with large numbers of UR reviews that they do in the state of Tennessee, okay? And then if you go on to page two, then what we did is we tried to break it down according to physicians. So with all of the information that we had, and we tried to break it down with the number of physicians that were listed by these companies. And so we've got probably 80 physicians or more like 180 physicians that have done utilization review in the state of Tennessee. So on pages 2, 3, 4, and 5 were all of the physicians that we have that were listed, okay? And then on page 6, what we did is we eliminated those physicians that only had less than 20 reports. And so the last two pages, the last three pages, and we'll try to condense this later on. I just did this spreadsheet to get the information to you. So we have some physicians, and we probably have 40 physicians that have done more than 20 utilization reviews in the state of Tennessee, and some of them have fairly large numbers. So as an example, Dr. Barreto has done 600 during the course of 2022. Dr. Doherty, 599. Dr. Kahlo, 260. Dr. Mahajan, 230. Dr. Renequez, 250. And then Dr. Trout, 112. And so also are broken down their subspecialties, the subspecialties that were listed. So I thought that I think we got a lot of valuable information from this. We We know that there is a concentration of physicians. One of the interesting things is if you look in the report and in number three, there is the number of companies that listed that they reported using the same physician. Okay, and so there were one company, one physician is used by six companies. Another physician is used by seven. So there's a lot of subcontracting that's going on with these insurance companies and the UR organizations with providing these physician reviews. So I think that we've learned a lot from this, and I hope that we will be able to update it for 2023 and get more complete information.
Dr. Snyder, this is Misty. I wonder if there is a place that separates what some people actually call the utilization review process, which is the peer review process. How many of those are actually performed? Because a utilization review first level that's done by a nurse and approved would be counted in the number of utilization reviews, but not actually sent to a physician peer reviewer.
If you'll look on the first page of the report, okay, Travelers is listed as only having 106 denials. Okay, so therein is a figure that gives you some idea about approvals versus denials.
Great, thank you. Just wanted to make sure that we're sending an appropriate number of things over versus making sure folks are getting their treatment quickly.
Right. So we're trying to capture both of those.
So that's way out of alignment with the other insurers.
Well,
Sedgwick.
Yeah, but
In terms of reviews and denials.
Yes. Yeah.
So,
Dr. Talmadge, you can chime in here. Dr. Oglesby, you can chime in, but we very rarely ever see an appeal on a traveler's denial. Maybe, you know, if it's one a month, it's rare. Okay. As opposed to most of our business, which comes from some other organizations.
You put that so nicely.
Yeah. Can we say their name? I just did earlier. But,
so, anybody else want to look at this report?
Well, there's no.
So I thought that for first go round, and I want to commend Keisha Matcham, who is our utilization review specialist, who compiled these figures. A lot of work went into these, and so it would make her job a lot easier if we just had if we just asked the specific questions instead of an open-ended report. So. Kind of try to generate that for 2024.
Well, thank you for that work. That's enlightening, very much. All right, so we'll move on to occupational medicine clinics.
Last time I asked for any comments concerning occupational medicine clinics, and I have not received any. So we assume that provider interactions through the occupational medicine clinics are going as expected, which is to get the injured workers care. So whether or not it be on-site occupational medicine or whether it be off-site. But any comments that you can give us would be helpful.
I put together just a few numbers. Helpful. I don't know. In the on-site medical clinics that I work, Yes, we do panel. So every injured worker gets a choice of three. A full report of, or a first report of injury is filed on every injury, no matter how minor. But I think what speaks to the level of care is that 90%+ of the injured workers, when they choose from their panel, actually choose the on-site medical clinic. They seldom choose to go off-site. And you hate to say it, but a lot of times those who choose to go off-site have an agenda, you know. So I think that speaks well. About 80% of the work-related injuries that we see in the on-site clinics are very minor. The employers are very strict on reporting, so a scratch that doesn't bleed has to be reported. A minor contusion, sprain, strain has to be reported, and so most of those don't require or receive medical treatment. Usually, simple first aid treatment. The other 20% are anything from wounds that need suturing to fatalities, and thank goodness we don't have those too often. So very, very minor injuries typically are addressed there. I feel like the employers that commit to the expense of having the on-site clinics are very invested in the long-term good health and well-being of their employees, in addition to controlling their workers' comp dollars a little closer. One thing that I did check in with our medical managers on was that our on-site nurses, and in the clinics I'm in, about 90% of the staff is contract staff. So it's they're not directly employed by the company, and the on-site clinic nurses basically have no interactions with off-site healthcare providers, other than they will frequently call to schedule an appointment. We expedite that through the clinic to get visits a little bit sooner, and they definitely don't attend visits with the injured workers. If a visit is attended, it's with a certified nurse case manager. That's with a third party organization provided through the insurance company that goes with them. I'm sure not all are as good at that, because I have seen and actually in my office have had on-site nurses bring employees in, you know, but that's typically not the accepted or the norm. Is that basically
how
you guys
do things? Thank you. That's helpful.
Yeah. And I tried to talk a couple of the sites into letting you guys come tour and just see what the on-site clinic, how it's set up, how it runs, and I got several. We'll get back with you on that. So I'll let you know. I'll let you know if we get a.
I'm from the government and here to help you.
Does anybody else have any other comments or about that? If not, we'll move on to COVID.
So as of September the 30th, there were 14,997 COVID claims filed in the state of Tennessee. First payments were made on 1,646. We had 52 fatalities where the first report of injury was filed for COVID. That does not mean that they were all accepted as as COVID compensable. And at the present time, we have only one case for a long COVID claim that's presently in mediation. So we have seen very few claims for long COVID. Now, one of the things about the fact that 14,900 claims have been filed, that included those for individuals who were required to stay home for quarantine purposes, okay? So if their employer paid for their 2 weeks off, that would have been reported as a COVID claim, but there would have been no workers' comp benefits that would have been paid under that claim. So I think that was probably, to a large extent, why those numbers seem to be so skewed. But at the present time, we continue to follow this quarterly. We are so far surprised that we have not seen more long COVID claims under workers' compensation. So, but first you'd have to prove that the COVID itself was covered under the claim before we could get the long COVID claim approved. So maybe that's one of the reasons. But.
Are those numbers since the beginning, since 2019?
Yeah.
Are you getting any new ones this year?
We had, in 2023, we had 169 claims. 2020 was 6,000, 2021 was 5,400, 2022 was 2,700, so it's way down.
Dr. Snyder, Lisa Hartman has her hand raised.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir. Do you have those divided out into occupation? I was just curious if the healthcare workers filed anything. Because they were on the front lines in your emergency people. Are those numbers separated out into occupations?
We did not do that, but NCCI did. Okay. So they have nationwide statistics which showed that I think it was 30% of overall compensable claims that were approved were in healthcare workers, and another 20% were in service workers, such as grocery stores, those sorts mm-hmm. of things, non-medical. And I don't recall what the rest of the figures were, but NCCI has that on their website.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
But we did not break that down for the state.
Rob, did you guys have a many claims?
Almost none. I just didn't say it.
Hmm. Because you would think your folks would be frontline
yeah.
service.
Were you closed for a period of time?
Oh, yeah. The whole country was shut down.
Yeah. So how long were your stores? Do you remember?
Was it a month, maybe? I got a blur that year. It was several weeks. Was it April, May? Whenever that was, that part of that year. But we didn't even get any guests. I thought we'd get some guest lawsuits out of it, but didn't see that either. I think just because of the difficulty in trying to say you got it from there versus the 35 other places in that day. And when did you get it? You know, who knows what day you got it. It's so hard. We just didn't see it.
Interesting. Any other comments on COVID? If not, we'll move on to new business, the NCCI.
So we received the annual medical data report the end of September for the service year of 2022. So realize this is essentially this year-old data, okay, from 2022. So they analyzed 1.2 million transactions on 61,000 claims, which were 94% of the commercial premiums paid. And in the state of Tennessee, they paid $242 million worth of medical payments to providers in the state of Tennessee. So we're talking about some pretty big numbers, and it has to do with workers' compensation come down to it. 63% of the total benefits paid are medical, which is higher than the region or the nation. This may have something to do with the fact that the indemnity payments in the state of Tennessee are lower than the payments in the region and the nation on average. And so it would skew that percentage upward toward the medical costs being higher. The distribution of payments to different medical groups is about the same. In other words, physical therapy and one good urgent care and inpatient hospital and physician services, all of those sorts of different groupings, our distribution of payments is about the same. Our physician payments as a percent of Medicare is higher than the region, but it's mixed when it comes to difference in the national averages because of the fact that, that some states have no fee schedules. Some states go at 300% of Medicare, so there's a spread on that. Shoulder treatment and surgery costs, initial treatment, radiology, physical therapy, anesthesia, and surgery lead all other body parts in medical payments paid. Inpatient treatment costs in Tennessee are slightly higher than the region and the nation and to Medicare equivalents. There's a higher use of ambulatory surgery and diagnostic centers and a slightly lower use of hospital outpatient services than in the region and the nation. So the reason for that is that the providers as well as the insurers are using non-hospital-based services for outpatient surgery, for diagnostic procedures, things like that. So they seem to have a better control of a cost than sending them to the hospital outpatient centers. So I think that's a good figure. And prescription drug spend is on par with the region and the nation. However, Schedule II drugs, which are the opioids, are prescribed and filled in the region more than in the region or the nation by 5%. So we're significantly higher in opioid prescriptions and filled prescriptions. 10% more claims have opioids. 10% more of the claims have opioids written for them than in the state of the than in the nation. Okay, and the average number of milligram medical equivalents, is 35% higher than in countrywide. So we have a significant problem with the amount of opioids that are still being written.
What is the average morphine equivalent? Do you know?
It's like 1,800 per year, something like that. Now, what's interesting is that almost all of the difference between the percentage of the opioids being prescribed has to do with claims that are over 10 years old. So it's not the new claims which seem to be generating a significant difference in the amount of opioids being written, but it's these claims that are over 10 years old.
Okay. Do you have any data that shows how Tennessee compares to the nation now at 5% more? Compared to 5 years ago?
Yes.
Are we trending in the right direction?
Yes, we are. Good. So all of these figures have fallen since 2018. So we're doing better. We're still above the rest of the nation. So that's a summary of the report. Any questions?
So the old claims, that's what's bumped us up 5%. We think. Okay.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, do you still have a lot of workers' comp patients on, and are they mostly the old claims?
I don't think in the last 2 years I literally have started anybody on opioid freshly. So,
okay.
Again, we had talked in the past about separating out the groups, the old legacy patients versus the new ones. And it's just awfully hard to get those old patients off. I mean, it's just almost impossible. But even the CDC the revision guidelines accepted that. So you've got to treat them differently. So my goal is to try to get them down below 40 or 50 the best I can. It's just hard to get them off. But the key is for the future, don't let it turn into what we've done in the past. And I've been successful doing that, as I think Lisa Bellner has. So it's just a mindset of how you approach pain with these new injuries.
I see a lot of folks come back from the emergency room and they'll still have a small opioid prescription or a post-op opioid prescription.
Well, I think the surgeons are doing much better too. Not writing them for 6 months and then turning over to pain management, but maybe going, I just want to get you to pain management, and hopefully pain management doesn't keep them going, but trying to.
In the acute setting, we use the ibuprofen Tylenol combination, and it's amazing. I mean, how well it works. It's cheap.
Most cheap. It's
hard. Yeah. So the two prescriptions that are of interest to note is as a group, the benzodiazepines are the ones that have the most prescriptions written in the state of Tennessee for workers' comp. And the single prescription that has the most is gabapentin. So those one group and one particular medication are the ones that are the greatest number of prescriptions written, and the group with the greatest number of prescriptions.
There's got to be psychiatrists writing the benzos, right? I don't think pain specialists are doing that much anymore.
No, but it's just, there's a lot of it being written.
Primary care.
Not saying it's bad or wrong. It's right. Just that's what it is.
And that's more than NSAIDs, or that's more than anything.
Those aren't captured in the schedule.
Scheduling. Okay. Just capturing. Okay. Wow. All right. Any other comments? Questions? Any announcements?
Well, I'm sure that she's going to be embarrassed, but I would like to say that Susie is going to receive her 30-year award in December. And I've been on this committee ever since it was formed in 1992, with the 1992 change. And my contact almost the entire time has been Susie, and she is what's kept this committee and me in order for that long. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Congratulations, Susie.
Thanks.
So you must have been, what, 8 or 9 when you started, right?
If
right
that.
Out.
Right,
yeah.
Out.
Yeah.
Right
yeah.
Out of grade school.
All right. So our next meeting will be in March of 2024, March 12th. I guess anything else before we wrap up today?
I want to wish everybody happy holidays, and I want to thank everybody for their participation, because it means a lot to us to get the feedback, and hopefully we are providing service to you, and also to hopefully we're making progress in helping our injured workers.
Thank you. All right. Happy holidays, everybody.
Same to you. Okay. Same back to y'all.
See you next year.
Thanks, everybody. So much for all you do.